Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, of course, and co-hosting today is Michael Butterfield. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing well. How are you, Al?
I'm always good, even when I'm sick. Wear your mask around me today.
Yeah, I'll stay away from the microphone just to be safe.
Yeah, that's it. No, it should be all okay. We'll be quarantined in a studio together for 4 weeks.
No. Now, that sounds like a horror movie.
Yeah, it is. I mean, well, the whole country's in a horror movie right now. Speaking of quarantine, we've got the great David Talbot with us today. How you doing, David?
I am very healthy, thank you, Al.
That's good.
Down here in San Francisco, miles away.
Good place to be, actually. Well, I think. Now, David, now we know you, of course, from a couple of great books from before, you know, the Devil's Chessboard and the Season of the Witch. Season of the Witch is incredible. I love that book myself.
Thank you.
Now we come up to the newest book of Between Heaven and Hell, and it's the story of my stroke. Now, this one really kind of, I've listened to it twice. It's pretty, I can't come up with the word, but it really affected me. I think a couple of reasons. One, my mother had a stroke and died from it. And just recently, I don't know if you knew Hank Alparelli.
Yes, of course.
And that really shocked me. He had a stroke and then he died, and I had just been talking to him. We were texting back and forth, and we were talking because I was getting someone, Sean Sullivan, and he knew him and he was coming on the show. So we were talking ahead of time and we were doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden he's stroke, and then I was just, wow, that really, man, it's devastating.
No, I remember that, and I knew Hank, and not well, but I respected his work, of course. And when I heard about his death from a stroke, it always is a sober reminder of how fortunate people who do survive, like myself, are, because so many don't.
Right. So when you explain that, and the stroke and stuff, how is recovery for something like that to where you are now? I mean, you're functioning, you're doing speeches, and writing, and you're quite active on social media. So what was the recovery time?
Well, it was quite lengthy in really, and it began in the hospital. You know, Al, I write about it in Heaven and Hell, Between Heaven and Hell. It took 5 weeks actually for them to kind of piece me together again in the hospital in the stroke ward down here in San Francisco in Davies Hospital, a very good stroke ward unit, and you know, all kinds of therapists, physical therapists, you know, doctors, neurosurgeons, you know, kind of like Humpty Dumpty and all the King's Men were trying to put me together again. I couldn't walk. I couldn't swallow. I couldn't see straight. So it was one day at a time. I had to learn how to be very patient after being a kind of alpha male my whole life and hard charging. My wife called me Mr. Toad from the Wind in the Willows because I tended to be very propulsive and compulsive. And so even the stroke ward staff had to tell me to slow down as they were kind of rehabbing me. But, you know, I had to relearn to walk and speak. So, you know, I just, thanking people like Hank Alberelli, I feel so fortunate. And my own mother, not speaking of mothers, died of a stroke, actually, a series of strokes. And she was much younger when she died than I am. She was 60, and I'm 68 now. So, you know, there, but for the grace of God, and I think about that all the time, and, you know, I had to learn how to be patient. It took me another year, year and a half, really, after getting out of the hospital to be kind of functional. I am now walking around. I can't drive, but I walk outside with a cane just to be careful. I'm kind of chronically dizzy, you know, kind of discombobulated a little bit. And, you know, speaking still a little bit of a strain now and then, as you might be able to detect. But, you know, all in all, I'm operating at the same level. Some people think I'm even kind of intellectually more acute now these days. I'm a little easier to live with, I think, too. I'm a little less kind of driven and you know, stressed out as I used to be. I had to learn how to be a little more patient.
Well, I think you sound really good.
Yeah.
From me. And I was curious, how does that affect your writing?
Yeah.
Well, that was really weird, you know, because I never was particularly introspective as a writer. I wrote about power and politics, history, you know, the big subjects that men tend to write about. And you know, I kind of was reluctant to do a memoir because I thought that was kind of a narcissistic exercise. And frankly, most memoirs, really, I think most memoirists haven't earned the right to write about themselves because their lives aren't all that deep or interesting, and they're not that great at writing about them. But, you know, I can count on that two hands maybe with the great memoirs I've read, where a person has lived a life fully enough and is articulate enough about writing about it that they've, as I say, earned the right to do that. So, you know, writing this particular book began more as an exercise for me. It was a therapeutic exercise. I did it on Facebook. I couldn't write. I still can't touch type. I can't use my right hand with the same dexterity. And so I had to unpack each word I had to correct. I was making mistakes all the time. So I was writing painstakingly slowly. But I needed to communicate with other people and to see if I could still write a sentence, if I could still gather my thoughts. And lo and behold, you know, what I wrote about my recovery, about my stroke, and what I'd been through began to hit a nerve with people. Hundreds of people on my Facebook page, thousands really, ultimately, began writing back to me about their own ordeals, you know, heart attacks, strokes they'd had, other kind of calamities, cancer, or loved ones who died. And so they really inspired me to keep going. And then a publisher down here in San Francisco, Chronicle Books, Mark Talbert, had just been hired there to run a new imprint at Chronicle Books, and he was kind of a fan of my writing and was aware of what I was writing, and he helped guide me and say, look, this could be a book. And that was the first time I thought my story might have a wider audience. And, you know, I've been so kind of gratified as I go around speaking here in the Bay Area to really quite big audiences. People, I think, are just glad to see me alive again. And know that I can help inspire others who've been through something similar. I feel I'm in a brotherhood of the sort of half alive people in a way, because the stroke does that to you. You feel like you're in shadow and light, and you never fully, I think, for most people at least, recover. You're always aware that the shadow is still there, and I don't mind that as a writer, being a little more interior, a little more aware of the dark side now.
Mm. And you mentioned two strong women in your life and how they survived, but how that changed them personally. And I know that from a fact from my partner's mother that had a stroke. And then afterwards, she cried at almost anything. And before that, she was a real strong, aggressive woman. Mm. Do you find that it's changed you in that way as well?
Yeah, I describe my emotions as like a mountain storm now. I mean, they're very unpredictable. I will cry for the slightest provocation. You know, one of the most emotionally overwhelming moments for me after my stroke was it was not long after I came home. My son, Joe Talbot, began filming his first feature as a director, a young director. He made the movie The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which was a huge critical hit. Yeah. Last year. And so to see Joe at age 28, after all the ups and downs that his mom, Camille, and I have been through as his parent, you know, there he was directing this army of people on the streets of San Francisco, police, you know, shutting down streets, you know, crew running everywhere, actors getting into character. And Joe was the sort of calmness at the center of the storm as a director, and I was so proud of him. And, you know, the fact that I lived long enough to see him make his first movie, which I knew had been his dream for years. He'd been working 5 years with Jimmy Fails, the star of the movie, who's like another son to us, you know, on this film. And finally it came to fruition. They got the backing from Brad Pitt's company, Plan B, and from A24, and they were off, and they were doing this amazing, beautiful movie. And then he won Best Director Award Sundance later. And to be there on the icy streets at Park City and not knowing whether I could even walk, you know, just seeing the acclaim of, and a standing ovation that the film got there. And then it's been a magic ride ever since. So that is one of the main reasons I'm glad I'm still alive. It's not so much what I have to do anymore. I feel I've written the books that I need to write. But it's seeing my loved ones and what they're accomplishing now. My wife is writing her own book, a beautiful literary biography of Robert Louis Stevenson and his American wife, who's this kind of kick-ass pioneer woman, Fanny Stevenson. So I just enjoying sort of this kind of creative achievement around me from afar.
How's this affected you spiritually? Like, I didn't really take you as a religious person, so... does this change that?
Yeah, well, I use an image from William Blake on the cover because, strangely, in the middle of my stroke, I didn't realize I was having the stroke the first 24 hours. It was called a stuttering stroke. It was kind of clandestine. I didn't realize that, you know, I was in the first stages of a stroke. In any case, I was, for some reason, channeling the kind of ecstatic art of the poet and painter William Blake, and I used an image saying that I was trying to give people some kind of hope because we're going through yet another sort of dark period, post-Trump period, or in the middle of Trump at the time, and telling people, you know, hang in there, we'll get through this. And I put this image of Blake, from Blake, and that's the image that is on the cover of my book. So I had this strangely ecstatic experience. It was both, like I say, like going through hell, but it was also strangely uplifting, what I've been through. It reminded me of how precious life is. It reminded me how lucky I am to be alive still. It reminded me of savoring each moment I am still alive. I used to, in the past, you know, like most of us, live for the future, live for deadlines. I was always on as a writer, as a journalist. Business deadlines, journalistic deadlines, you know, I was never in the moment. And so reading, you know, simple kind of, you know, advice, like from people who are kind of, you know, simple but deep at the same time, like Ram Dass, the spiritual guide from my generation, who had a stroke at my age, and he lived many years more. He died just recently. And, of course, his famous book was Be Here Now. So I learned the wisdom of that. Be here now is living day to day, moment to moment, because I realize now how contingent, how kind of fragile life is for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. Now you still stayed active, and I know you sent me that speech about the deep state then and now, and for the Praxis Peace Institute. So the deep state, Donald Trump, what keeps him going against something like the deep state?
Well, you know, many of us who are scholars of American history, presidential history, as in my case, going back to, you know, the 20th century and the Cold War and the Kennedy administration, you know, as I write in my book, Brothers, and then in The Devil's Chessboard, I think I make a convincing case that Kennedy was the victim of the national security state because he was trying to end the Cold War prematurely and met with massive resistance from what Eisenhower had warned him about, the military-industrial complex. And by the end of his administration, I had interviewed many people who had worked for him, Arthur Schlesinger, Robert McNamara, Ted Sorensen, they all said that the administration had really shrunk to a very small size, that he only could depend on his brother, Bobby Kennedy, Attorney General, and a handful of other advisors. He didn't control the Pentagon. He didn't control the CIA. That's what Arthur Schlesinger, the historian who worked for Kennedy, told me. He didn't control the State Department. So Kennedy ultimately, I think, was gunned down by a conspiracy that grew out of the national security state. And Alan Dulles, I think, played a key role in orchestrating that coup, really, and also the cover-up, because Alan Dulles had been director of the CIA under Kennedy until he was fired after the Bay of Pigs debacle in Cuba, then got himself appointed by President Johnson to the Warren Commission. And so you had a case of the foxes, you know, controlling the investigation. Anyway, why has Trump, though, been able to survive the animosity of these many of these same types, people in the national security establishment? Former CIA Director John Brennan, who served under Obama, was in an open war with Trump from the very beginning. Of course, the people who blew the whistle on him over the Ukraine scandal were CIA officers who worked within the CIA, the White House. And, you know, much of the CIA and the national security state was testifying against him and trying to overthrow him during the impeachment process. They failed. They struck at the king and they failed to kill him. So he's now emboldened. Now, how did he survive? I make the case in my recent speech, which I delivered down here in Sonoma to the peace group, as you mentioned, Praxis, was I think Trump has succeeded in dividing and conquering the deep state. You know, while elements of the CIA are adamantly opposed to him, he meanwhile appointed the queen of torture herself, Gina Haspel, to be director of the CIA. And she broke protocol by coming to the last State of the Union speech and jumping to her feet and applauding some of his most bellicose lines. So he's won over a number of people in the deep state while insulting and infuriating others, like former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and others who tried to school him about the necessity of diplomacy over war. And he, of course, you know, famously insulted them as babies, as losers, mm-hmm. and so on. So while he's alienated a significant faction of the CIA, of the Pentagon, of the national security state, he's won over enough of it for one thing, increasing their budget enormously and giving them free hand to do pretty much whatever they want around the world. There's so little, if any, civilian oversight now over our military and spy operations. So he's emboldened, he's empowered, he's lavished, you know, huge amounts of money on them, and he's succeeded in seducing enough of them, winning enough of them over, where they can't move in kind of a coordinated fashion against him. For one thing, also, the deep state is much bigger, more sprawling than it was during Kennedy's time. There's so many more agencies, more players, more power centers. So it was possible back in the early 60s for an Alan Dulles, who was quite a strong figure, to develop a consensus within the national security complex that Kennedy had to go. It's not possible anymore to develop that same kind of consensus within the deep state. It's just too big and too complex.
So now, what do you think of the timing now? So we've got Donald Trump in. We've got a fairly, I don't know what you call it, dark times, I guess. It's pretty rough. And now the Democrats coming with two major candidates pretty much left. Where's that
going
to go?
Well, you know, look, I'm a Bernie person, so I'm kind of in mourning after Super Tuesday. I was expecting and hoping for Bernie to do better, and at least to win key states like Texas and Massachusetts. So that was a setback. And, of course, you know, look, the Democrats are capable of playing some of the same voter suppression tricks that the Republicans do, particularly in Texas, the long lines, the voting machines that don't work, the voter suppression in the Latino district. You know, we don't have to go into that. We all know that. But in any case, it was still disappointing, Bernie's turnout. He didn't get the young vote in the massive new numbers that he needed and so on. So I think, you know, we may at the end of the day have to live with a Joe Biden, a ticket. And, you know, of course, we'll see if he's smarter than Hillary Clinton, who should have reached across the ideological aisle and brought a Bernie Sanders type on her ticket. Instead, she put a bland centrist, Tim Kaine, on the ticket. We'll see if Biden's going to be as arrogant or if he's going to try and bring the party together by bringing a Bernie type on the ticket with him. In any case, I don't think Biden's a strong candidate. He's in many ways even weaker than Hillary Clinton. He seems old and doddering to me. He seems like he never was a particularly good debater. He's never particularly intellectually sharp. He's now he seems more befuddled than ever. I don't think he's going to match up well against Trump on the debate stage. We've seen his sort of screaming old man act now, you know, it's kind of ridiculed on Saturday Night Live very effectively in other places. But at the end of the day, I think we have to, sadly, rally around this weak Democratic candidate because as corporate and as sort of pro-war and as, corrupt in many ways as Biden is and his legacy, he sure as hell is an improvement over the disaster we have in the White House now. So I'm hoping that Biden, at the end of the day, I think, as I say, brings together the party and brings the progressive wing into his candidacy. That remains to be seen. But I don't think he can win without strong progressive support. Bernie Sanders controls, you know, somewhere close to 50% of the party, and that includes people like me. So, you know, I'm not giving up on Bernie yet. We'll see about Michigan next week. That's a key battleground state. And if he wins there, you know, game on.
Right, right. You just don't know. It can change real quick.
Yeah, and it would be better if we had a wicker chair in office right now. So
that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hey, look, I'm all blue all the way, you know, anybody but Trump. And so, you know, I will, like I say, I'll get hell for this from some of my Bernie fans. But, you know, I will vote for Biden and I will, actively support his campaign. But I hope we're not there quite yet. As I say, I'm going to wait at least until we see how he does in battleground states like Michigan in the primary next week.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And Florida is important as well, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of depressing. Actually, and I would think that a lot of the fans of your books would probably be more Trump followers.
Well, yeah, I too tend to cross over a bit. And in fact, Bernie himself, of course, has attracted some support from former Trump supporters. A lot of white kind of working class guys from those battleground states are showing up at his rallies because they know they've been sold out. And the liberal elites have been part of their betrayal, not just sort of the right-wing Republicans. And they know Bernie is the real deal. He would confront corporate power. He will empower unions. He'll empower, you know, working people. He'll narrow the wealth gap by taxing the super wealthy and so on. So there's a reason why a lot of those Trump types who feel like marginalized and angry that they've been screwed over by the liberal elites, there's a reason why they're coming to Bernie rallies. There's also a reason, like you say, some of them do read my books. I believe that American democracy has been sold out. It's been sold out most of my life. And that the wrong people won. And that these people were the corporate elite, the people who belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. People are in power, you know, sort of permanently in power, in the power elite, in the deep state, whatever you call it, that mainly exist to empower Wall Street and the 1% over the rest of us. So, you know, yes, if my books offer some enlightenment about how power really works in America, it's not only the left-wing people or liberals who want to read that. It's people who are, you know, sort of Trump types, too, in many cases, or libertarians who distrust state power. So I'm happy to have a wide ideological spectrum of readers.
So what do you think the outcome, what do you think it's the, how is it going to turn out for all of us here if Trump gets in again?
Well, I think the country will continue to fracture. I think we'll have all sorts of, you know, even civil disturbance beginning. The environment is now under such stress. And the fact that he denies science, he denies the climate crisis, gets actually more worrisome by the day. We now know that we're living in the hottest year in recorded history. We have an entire country that was on flames, Australia. We've never seen anything like the inferno down there that changed the climate itself. It was creating such, you know, hot, high temperatures from the fires there. So, you know, we have our problems here in California every year. The fire season is longer than ever. It has destroyed, you know, whole swaths of the state. PG&E, our utilities, has gone bankrupt from dealing with the effects of the fires, partly that they've caused. So, you know, we're seeing a real crisis around the world that the Trump administration refuses to acknowledge. So I think these problems will only the wealth gap, the student debt crisis, all the problems, the healthcare epidemic. You know, now we're seeing the holes in our public health system more and more because the coronavirus epidemic. All these things Bernie Sanders is speaking to, and he alone is really speaking as forcefully as he is about them. Elizabeth Warren, to some extent. But she's failed to actually make any impact, unfortunately, at the ballot box. So it was all on Bernie's shoulders, a 78-year-old guy, to wake up the country. And young people, by and large, are really, you know, jumping on his bandwagon because they realize they're screwed. You know, my kids are in their 20s. I have two sons, and I really fear for their future and their own children if they decide to have them. Many young people decide not.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even to bring new kids into the world because they're so alarmed about the future. So what do I think? I think we're in for even worse next 4 years if Trump does manage to get reelected. I don't think, you know, Biden would be that much better, but he'll be somewhat better. And so, look, you know, Noam Chomsky once argued against some lefties, you know, about who said, oh, we shouldn't just keep voting for the lesser of two evils. And Noam Chomsky rightly said, yeah, but voting for the lesser of two evils means you get less evil. And so that's what we have to do. We have to be smart.
Or the
and
evil
we have
of
to be strategic.
Yeah, or it's the evil of two lessers, as they say. I have a quick question for you about the coronavirus thing you were just mentioning. I just saw on the news that, you know, yesterday the World Health Organization amended the mortality rate by saying it's not 2.3%, it's actually more like 3.5%. And then just on the news, while you were talking about Trump denying climate science, I saw that he's saying that the World Health Organization is probably wrong about that. How do you think that kind of stuff is going to affect us, especially when you see that he's cutting the funding for the CDC and other things like that?
Well, you know, his rank and file, his base, is with him all the way and tends to believe when he cries fake news. And look, you know, his accusations of fake news against the corporate media aren't altogether wrong. You know, the New York Times was filled with so much anti-Bernie venom, as he called it, in the last weeks, particularly leading up to Super Tuesday, that you have to acknowledge that the liberal media, so-called, the corporate media, have a huge bias, and they're trying to maintain their vision of the status quo. And an outsider like Bernie Sanders is seen as a, you know, a hostile agent by the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, CNN. So they did everything they could to crush his surging. When it comes to science, though, you know, I believe in it. You know, I don't have my head in the sand. And so I tend to listen to doctors. My sister's a doctor in Portland, Oregon. I talked to her recently about the epidemic. I read, you know, medical bulletins and warnings, and I take them seriously. We have an idiot, as you know, in the White House, a man who doesn't believe in any kind of factual-based world. So I'm not taking any advice from him about how to protect myself and my family against the epidemic. On the other hand, I, as a skeptical journalist, just have some questions about whether this epidemic is being somewhat overplayed. The hysteria now is having major worldwide economic impacts. And, you know, I was saying earlier to Al that, you know, most of the front section, of news section of the New York Times today, which I get every day, I'm old school, I get the print version, most of that front section is dominated by the coronavirus epidemic. I've never seen that ever, where, you know, one kind of story, alarming as it is, dominates the entire news section of the daily New York Times. So has the media gone a little bit too far? I tend to think so. On the other hand, I don't believe Trump for a minute. I think the truth about the virus probably exists somewhere in between. And I think the truth, because we haven't had enough testing, we don't even have enough testing kits in this country, we still don't know the full extent of what the epidemic could mean. So, hey, look, I think I'm alarmed, but not unduly so at this point. I'm waiting and looking for more information each day.
And the big question is, what do we do? I mean, Trump is just there, and he promotes this stuff. But when he's gone, what about all of his followers? They're still there. They don't leave the country just because Trump gets out. So how do we reckon with those, that type of logic?
Well, Trump both caused the grown skepticism and disbelief in our institutions, but it also preceded Trump. And there's a reason why, you know, government has so little credibility. Our agencies, our government agencies, they do tend to be sort of bought and owned by the corporate sector. And there's a reason why our media have so little kind of credibility with so many people, not just on the right, but among people like me on the left, too. Because they're seeing it again as bias towards the corporate interests, towards Wall Street, towards centrist campaigns like Joe Biden. And so, you know, I think what we need to do, though, as a society, is to begin to rebuild our civil institutions. I think we need to actually, in my profession, rebuild faith in journalism, which is very important, cornerstone of democracy, of course, by actually doing more credible journalism and challenging the editorial sort of hierarchies of these institutions, not to be so slanted, not to be so anti-Bernie in this case, or, you know, so pro-Wall Street in other ways. You know, they were covering, I saw an article today, every time the economy was mentioned as being strong, which is kind of actually, you know, a story that has a lot of holes. The economy is not strong in many ways, but every time the economy was talking, you know, people wrote about it as being on the upswing, Trump was credited with that upswing, even though it began far before Trump under President Obama. And so there's this kind of, you know, sometimes even latent misleading information we get in the press that needs to be challenged. And I think social media actually is a good bullshit detector. Social media gets a lot, you know, flack these days for good reasons, you know, because it is often infiltrated and distorted. But I, from my experience, people are very skeptical on social media and kind of weed things out and find the information that they feel is valid. They share that and so on. And at least in my kind of community online, these are very sharp people. So it empowers them to use social media to talk back to the corporate media to say, look, you know, you're not reading this, you're not seeing it the right way. I think we all need to be more activists as citizens and not just sort of a rabble screaming and yelling and being whipped into a frenzy by demagogues like Donald Trump, but by being smart, responsible citizens that read, you know, reputable sources of information, come to our own decisions, and then vote in the right way or join organizations. It's not just voting every 2 or 4 years. It's being, we have to be citizens 24/7 now. I belong to a civic organization here in San Francisco. I, you know, I speak before groups all the time. That's what we have to do. We can't go to sleep like we did after we elected Obama and think, oh, he's got this, it's all cool. Obama disbanded his movement. That was a mistake. We have to stay mobilized, like I say, 24/7.
Yeah, so stop watching Fox News, Mike.
Yeah, because that's what I'm known for.
24/7.
Hey, or watch them, but, you know... watch, you know, a full spectrum of other sources, too.
Yeah. Most of it's become very, it's just opinion, you know, there's not much news. You know, it's just people talking.
I'll give you advice, give you a suggestion, your listeners, but one good source of reported information, not just, as you say, commentary. We see all the commentary all the time, is The Intercept. That's Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill's publication. They're both, of course, very good journalists. Glenn down in Brazil is fighting tooth and nail with the fascist regime down there, Bolsonaro. But he also weighs in, of course, on issues in the U.S. And, of course, he was very involved in the Edward Snowden case, won the Pulitzer for his work on that expose. And Jeremy Scahill's been a great reporter, investigative reporter for years. And their publication online is called The Intercept. And so they, one of the few sources of independent investigative reporting that I find very credible.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Good advice. What are you going to go next? Like, what do you plan on doing now? Are you going to get into another book or more research, or are you just going to just fight the good fight with politics right now?
Well, I do owe my publisher, HarperCollins, one more book, and then I'm going to hang it up because book writing takes a lot out of you. I couldn't have done this book myself. I was contracted to do that before my stroke, but I then went to my sister, Margaret Talbot, who's a great writer on staff of the New Yorker magazine. And Margaret, God bless her, agreed to collaborate with me. So we're both working on this book. It's called By the Light of Burning Dreams, and I think we really need it these days, because what it is, it's going to be a profile of eight American revolutionaries, not from the old days, but from the 60s and 70s. And these are going to be moments in their lives. Dennis Banks and Madonna Thunderhawk from the American Indian Movement, Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers, and a number of others, looking at decisions they made in their life, major decisions that not only changed their lives forever, but the course of American history. And so in Dennis Banks and Madonna Thunderhawk's case and Russell Means, the leaders of the American Indian Movement, I look at Wounded Knee, that amazing, stand they took in South Dakota in 1973, and how they withstood the entire might of the Nixon's army encircled their encampment there. They had occupied this hallowed ground of the Wounded Knee Massacre back in the 1800s. And for months, they held on for weeks and weeks. All kinds of firepower was directed at them, amazingly. Only two Indians were killed, Native Americans. But the question was, how could Dennis Banks get out at night? How could he live to fight another day? Because they knew his people that they were going to kill him when they arrested him. That was how angry and mobilized Nixon's forces were. And so the story of how he escaped that night, how he was led to freedom by a young Navajo named Lenny Foster, is an amazing story. And living to fight another day, really, is the American Indian motto. That's what they've had to do for so many years now. So I was fortunate to interview Dennis Banks before his death not long ago, and Lenny Foster, who was a young Indian at the time, who was the scout who led them through the enemy line, so to speak, a terrifying night where they got through and they escaped on the final night of the Wounded Knee Siege. So I think this book will give people some hope, some inspiration, talk about some of the mistakes that the people in the movement, as it was called in those days, made, what we can learn from today as we rebuild a new America. And so that's what I'm working on with my sister.
Oh, sounds good. What do you think of the left back in the 60s and 70s compared to now? I mean, one of the comments you have is at the beginning of your speech is, why is Donald Trump still in office and still alive? And I've heard people comment that, like, why isn't someone, taking him out? And that, not that I'm saying that that's what should happen, but the left seemed to be much more aggressive in the 60s and 70s with the Black Panthers and all the movements, and people were more focused, and they had people on the right paid attention to them compared to now. Do you think it's quite a bit weaker now, or what's your thoughts?
Yeah, and by the way, the violence back in the 60s and 70s, political violence, was overwhelmingly coming from the right.
Yeah.
coming from the organized, you know, state power in the case of the assassinations of the two Kennedys, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. Those were not from the left, of course. The violence that came from the left was fairly minimal in comparison. There was a lot of racist, malicious stuff, right-wing stuff all through the 60s and 70s, like we have today. The right, the left-wing violence was kind of limited, like the Weather Underground briefly, you know, had sort of committed acts of terrorism to protest the war and what they felt was an imperialist state. But they tried to avoid casualties, actually, after blowing themselves up in the famous townhouse explosion in New York, where several members of the Weather Underground were killed. So for the most part, they made sure that there weren't people in the buildings they blew up and so on, and they took precautions. I don't agree with that path, by the way. I felt that was wrong, and certain people who I do respect enormously out of the 60s who were great New Left leaders, like Tom Hayden, was invited to go underground, you know, in those years, and ultimately made the right decision to stay above ground and keep working as an activist. And then, of course, he went into electoral politics. I think that was the great mistake of the New Left, by the way, that not enough people followed Tom Hayden's path into electoral politics. Tom, of course, ran for U.S. Senate in California when he was married to Jane Fonda. They had a very powerful progressive organization here in California that really moved the Democratic Party to the left under Jerry Brown. They formed an alliance with him as when he was governor. And they made a lot of great changes, you know, in energy and sort of corporate regulation, environmental regulation, and so on. They had a real impact in California. Tom recently died, of course. Now, he was called a sellout by many on the left, though. They thought that, he was compromising too much by going into electoral politics, which they felt was too corrupt. You know, but Bernie Sanders' campaign actually echoes Tom Hayden's Senate campaign in many ways, in calling for national health insurance, for a transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy. So some of these themes haven't changed, sadly, in like the last 30, 40 years. So what do I think we need today? I think we do need to learn that you need to build a movement like Bernie Sanders has, not just get into electoral politics, but keep a movement going, because you're going to lose. That's the nature of politics. You will lose more times than you win, probably. But then you start to win, and you catch energy if you stay together. In San Francisco, it looked, for instance, that big tech had totally taken over this town. You know, many more homeless on the street, the wealth gap exploding. The city I felt that I loved and I celebrated in The Season of the Witch, my book about San Francisco history, I felt we were losing it to just 1 or 2 years ago. And lo and behold, then we've elected a string of progressive, fiery progressive officials to office in the last year alone. Chesa Boudin, who, by the way, is the son of two other underground members. They were in jail when he grew up, and he was raised by two other members of the Weather Underground. He became our district attorney, of all things, normally a law and order position. But he ran a very strong reformist campaign, and he won. San Francisco is now got a super majority of progressives on the Board of Supervisors, and we recently passed a number of progressive measures aimed at controlling corporate growth in the city and promoting affordable housing. So, you know, people are fighting back at the local level. I think we need to have that movement spirit the way we used to back in the 60s, where we called each other brothers and sisters. We felt that we were bringing a new world into being, and we knew that solidarity was very important. Whatever our personal disagreements were with people or our tribal disagreements, we needed to bring people together. And, you know, that's what Martin Luther King, by the way, was doing before he was killed. He was trying to put together an amazing coalition. I'm going to write about this in my new book, with the Poor People's March on Washington. Bobby Seale told me he reached out to him, to the Black Panthers. People thought, you know, Martin was all about civil rights and about nonviolence, but he was reaching out to the Panthers, who famously were armed, of course, to join him on this, not only a march on Washington, but an occupation. It was going to be an occupation of Washington to force Congress to transfer funds from the Vietnam War to social spending. And Bobby Kennedy had given Martin Luther King the idea to do this, two of our great leaders who both, of course, were tragically assassinated in 1968. And I believe that both of them were killed for a reason. So imagine if they had lived, if Martin Luther King, if he had succeeded in putting pressure on Congress to wind down the war in that year and begin shift money to poverty programs, to civil rights programs, and so on, we'd live under such a different country. Instead, my generation, baby boomers, you know, have Donald Trump in the White House. So I think we succeeded in many ways in the cultural wars, in you know, in terms of gay marriage and feminism, and in many other areas. But we have woefully not succeeded in a political transformation of the country. You know, the same powers that would control the country back then are controlling the country today. The forces of greed, of violence. We have permanent war. We have the wealth gap growing bigger than ever. We have the 1% in, you know, stranglehold controlling our political campaigns. With billionaires running for office or billionaires paying for campaigns. Michael Bloomberg is now, you know, subsidizing the Biden campaign with his fortune. You know, that's corruption. That's oligarchy, not democracy. So I think what we have to learn from the 60s is to get active again, get pissed off, and to be in this for the long haul, to build a movement that gets into politics and actually confronts power at its very source.
Well, on that note, I'd like to know if you're going to be doing any more public speaking.
I sure seem to be. I'm coming out of my shell, I think. I've been doing a lot of speaking in the Bay Area for the last month or so with the publication of my book, Between Heaven and Hell. And I'm ready to go. You know, if people invite me to their communities, I'll be there. I love Seattle, and my sister, I say, and her family are in Portland. I grew up in Los Angeles. You know, hey, the West is the best. We voted for Bernie. Let's not forget Nevada, Colorado, Utah. I guess, yeah. Washington and Oregon haven't have their primaries yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if Bernie won there too. You know, I think we're building a progressive network throughout the country, but particularly here in the West.
Yeah. Yeah, and me being a Canadian boy, I understand socialism in an economic state and not as a, a political thing. So, it's too bad people don't get it.
Well, they like socialism in effect. They like socialism when it helps them, that's for sure. Most people want national Medicare because they know what a nightmare the American medical system is. I mean, as soon as you have a problem, even if, when you have so-called insurance, you see how full of holes it is. And, I had to raise money for my own, health care through GoFundMe when I was in the stroke ward. And I had, Medicare still, but there were holes in my coverage. And, I wasn't making any money because obviously I was in no shape to write or speak, and I'm a freelancer. So my son, my wife, my family did a GoFundMe, and God bless all these people all around the country, most of whom I didn't know, but liked my writing, and they, contributed over $40,000 when we needed it most until I could get disability. So, Bernie has pointed out that what kind of country is it where people have to crowdfund their basic health care needs? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's immoral. So, whether or not Bernie triumphs, his ideas have to live on. We have to keep fighting for them. And if Biden does get elected president, we have to keep pushing him to enact Bernie's program as much as we can.
Yeah. I don't get it. I just don't understand it. My heart attack I had was 2 years ago. I was in Canada. It's all paid for and done. You don't pay any money, and the treatment was fantastic. So
yeah, as it should be.
It can be done. It's not. it's not impossible. So, anyway.
Yeah, and I remember you sent me a picture of your hospital room, and it looked like a hotel.
Yeah, I know, and I hear all these stories when I'm in L.A. and around in Seattle, and it's like, no, it's nothing like that. It's just fine. I don't understand where these stories come from. But
your commie pinko healthcare.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. It's a commie pinko.
Well, did you see, unfortunately, after Biden's good showing at Super Tuesday, health stocks in this country, the health insurance industry, soared because they knew that they were going to have, you know, someone friendly now leading the Democratic Party instead of Bernie, who feels that, what a radical idea, health care is the right, the privilege, as he always says. Boy, something has got to be done to curb the enormous power of the medical industry complex in this country, because until we do, people are going to be suffering, you know, millions of people who are going to be left uncovered or undercovered by the insurance industry, which exists not to help us, but to screw us and make obscene profits in big pharmaceutical industries, too. So Bernie's on the right track there. People support that. I think people are just afraid that he won't beat Trump. I think that was a lot of vote that Biden got, was out of fear. And now that people weren't voting their hopes, unfortunately. They were voting their fears.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think people are scared. You know, on the right, you've got a lot of people spewing about socialism as if in countries that are, you know, they have a political socialist country, and so they think that everything's being taken away from them, and they, you know, they just don't really get it. But
yeah,
you know,
there was a lot of scaremongering. It reminded me of the Cold War. A lot of scaremongering, you know, bringing up Cuba for God's sake and trying to hang Cuba around for Bernie's head. You know, Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes, and then, you know, crazy Chris Matthews, MSNBC, finally had to fire him. I know Chris. I used to be his editor back here at the San Francisco Examiner, where he started his journalism career a long time ago. You know, but he got crazier and crazier. And, you know, finally saying, you know, if Bernie Sanders wins, they're going to, it could be like Castro, you know, there could be hanging people in Central Park, people like me. Like, what the hell? I mean, you know, that's how insane the hysteria has become.
Yeah, it's too bad. Well, David, it's been great talking to you. Now, do you have a website as well, or just are you on Amazon and social media?
I'm on Facebook, actually. People should come to my Facebook page and join in the conversation. I update every day, so I'm very active there.
Fantastic. We're going to have your books on our website, and we'll have your Facebook page link as well, so people can just click on it and find it if they're listening. It's been incredible. Thank you for being on the show, David.
Well, thanks to both of you, and stay healthy.
Same to you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show.
To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.